Welcome to the Modern Law Library. I'm your host, Matt Reynolds, a legal affairs writer with the ABA Journal in Chicago. Today, it's my pleasure to be joined by novelist and lawyer Heather Srail, who writes under the name Marie Benedict, to talk about her novel, The Mitford Affair. Hi, Heather, how are you doing today?
Wonderful. So happy to be talking with you.
Yeah, me too. So your book, it tells the story of the Mitford sisters during the rise of Nazi Germany in the 30s and 40s. Could you just tell us a little bit about the three sisters who feature in the book?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, there are volumes about the sisters, but they were the three aristocratic it girls of the 1920s and 30s, British, each one more beautiful, brilliant, and eccentric than the next. And the story really focuses on the way in which three of the six sisters became caught in the crosshairs of World War II and really played an unexpected role in ultimately what happened in the war. And the way in which it unfolds has a lot of modern day resonance as well.
And I should ask you, like, about the Mitford sisters. Like, I actually got to admit, when I read this I hadn't really heard that much about them, but I was just like wondering what drew you to this story and what drew you to this family.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I am a writer on a mission. I write about unknown or lesser known historical women who have left a really important legacy for us and who have dealt with issues that really resonate into modern day. So I kind of have developed an antenna over time for these women because finding them and shining the light on them is really my goal. So I find them everywhere. I find them in research I'm doing, newspaper articles, conversations with friends. And I happened to be researching another book that I wrote about Winston Churchill's wife. It's called Lady Clementine. And I had known of the Mitford sisters. I had read some of their Nancy Mitford's books when I was in college, which was kind of a glimpse. They're fiction, but really autobiographical, and a glimpse into this really unusual sisterly relationship in the rarefied world that they inhabit. So they'd been on my radar a little bit. But when I researched this book about Clementine Churchill, the Mitford sisters figured in my research because they were cousins. They were much more than cousins, and we can talk about that, but they were at minimum cousins. And the way in which these two families really epitomized the polarizing political influences of the rise of World War II and that interwar period was unbelievable to me and just so captivating that I really felt compelled to uncover the way in which these family members each became drawn to and in some cases obsessed with, in turn, fascism, communism, socialism, I mean, you name it, and the way in which that could have, and in some ways did, play out in all of our histories. When I started to learn more about what happened, what they did, I just felt absolutely compelled to write the story.
You mentioned that family connection. Like, Winston Churchill features in the book, doesn't he? I don't think that's a spoiler to say that
he, it's not he a spoiler. Yeah. So, yeah, he does. He's a character. And he was in real life a character. You know, my books are very much wedded and mired in the research. The Mitford sisters, there were six of them, their father was ostensibly the cousin, first cousin to Clementine Churchill. Their mothers were sisters. But the reality is they were probably also half siblings. It is very likely that Clementine's father was her aunt's husband. So it's very complicated and actually much closer than the phrase cousin just in and of itself would suggest.
And I should ask you, like, writing about these larger than life historical figures like Hitler and Winston Churchill, I mean, obviously they've been immortalized in books, on TV, in films. Is that kind of daunting, having to explore these characters we've seen so many times in fiction before and in nonfiction as well?
Absolutely. I mean, in some cases, it deters me from writing the story. In this case in particular, I mean, I've written about as secondary characters because, you know, my primary character is always the woman. Albert Einstein, you know, Winston Churchill, and Hitler. I mean, what a trio. But yeah, I mean, in this case in particular, it took me a long time to kind of muster up the courage to write the story because two of the sisters become part of Hitler's inner circle. They become
both Unity and
Diana. I mean, they're absolutely enmeshed with him. And so I had to look at the most reprehensible character in history through the positive lens of these two characters in order to understand how they became so enraptured by him and his movement. And that was very, very challenging. The only way I could do it, and even then it still turned my stomach, was to rely on their letters recounting those relationships. So yeah, it's very daunting.
I wanted to ask you about the structure and how you kind of fell upon the structure, because you kind of give the three sisters kind of almost equal screen time, don't you, or time in the novel. How did you fall upon that? And were there any iterations of the book where you didn't take that approach, or was that kind of an approach you wanted to take from the beginning?
Well, gosh, that's a great question, because there are six sisters and each sister's story is equally mind-boggling. And I just touch on, but could have developed an entire separate storyline about the sister who became a communist, Deka, who I do hint at and do talk about, but I could have gotten into much more detail. You know, because I went into the story, as I do with most of my books, with a particular mission, you know, uncovering a legacy and exploring an issue that is one that is kind of inhabiting my own thoughts and is very modern in feel. And for me, it was the way in which our world has become so polarizing politically. And I was very interested in the way in which people develop these very disparate views, particularly within families. And nowhere is that more prevalent than in the Mitfords. You know, you've got socialists, Nazis, communists, you know, sort of people who are just following the monarchy, you've got it all. And in this family dynamic kind of allowed me to explore that. And this structure, focusing on the two sisters who really became instrumental and could have taken, you know, really rolled Nazism out in Great Britain should the Nazis been successful in their air campaigns, was a way to really do that. And using Nancy as the one who had to struggle in how far she would go with between her loyalty to her country and her loyalty to her sisters, that also felt really modern to me as well. You know, without taking sides in any political way, it was a way to explore how we evolve at these viewpoints and what we do when we're faced with them and asking ourselves whether there's a line that we, you know, just is not crossable for us. And so their particular situation really lent itself to that exploration, which I'd been really thinking about a lot myself.
And how challenging was to write from the perspective of the two sisters that are kind of in cahoots with Nazi Germany and Hitler?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because they each come to their fascination and adherence to Nazism through very different means, right? Unity is sort of the quintessential middle sister, the least attractive, the least intelligent, the tallest, the most ungainly in this sea of strikingly beautiful, famous sisters, right? For her, Nazism and her sort of pursuit of Hitler, she really became the English person with the closest personal contact and the most time with Adolf Hitler. I mean, she was in his inner circle. She came at it through a void with, I think, a void, and I write fiction, of course, these are my versions of these characters, a void within herself, a way to stand out and claim something for her own. And you know, we're looking at Hitler and Nazism through the benefit of hindsight. You know, there was an echelon of British society that found Nazism and fascism the lesser of other evils. You know, they saw communism coming, marching across Europe. And boy, communism wasn't going to let them keep their titles or their land, right? But the fascists, they might let that happen. So she wasn't the only one by a long stretch who found not the rise of Nazism very attractive. So she came by through one means. Diana, when the book opens, is actually married to the heir to the Guinness beer fortune and has two children. She has this luxurious life, and she falls head over heels in love with someone who's not her husband, Oswald Mosley, who is married and is head of the fascist movement in Great Britain. And she hadn't been particularly political before, but when she falls for him, she falls for his movement also, because it's a way to link her to him. To make herself indispensable in the fascist movement is to make herself indispensable to Oswald Mosley. And so she utilizes these connections that her sister, Unity, has forged with not the Nazis as a way to further her own particular agenda and romantic interest. So they come at it in very different ways. And I wouldn't say that I'm sympathetic, but I'm trying to understand the why and the how, because I'm trying to understand the why and the how in our world today. One of the things that really was a real, that's a theme in Nancy Mitford's books and is a realization of my own as well, is that political beliefs are often arrived at for very personal reasons. You know, when I was younger and much more naive, I think I used to think that people formed their political allegiances for ideological reasons, you know, because they really believed in X or Y or Z. And that may be true for some people, but for a lot of people, they come at their belief systems through very personal motivations. And understanding that helps me understand the variety of political beliefs and the reasons how someone might arrive at that belief system, right? And Diana and Unity each are fully brandishing the Nazi flag, yet they each come at that belief system for very different reasons and backgrounds.
Okay, well, that seems like a good time to take a break to hear from one of our sponsors.
Delegate out those tasks that take up your time. Staffy can help you with your legal, administrative, marketing, and even client-facing workload. Hiring Staffy's top-notch bilingual virtual staff means Staffy does the recruiting, hiring, and training for you. Then, if you need a change, Staffy handles it. You get to concentrate on your strategic work. Schedule a free consultation at staffy.cc. That's STAFI.cc and get $500 off with code HAPPY24.
So I'm here with novelist Heather Terrell. Heather, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the surprises in the research. What was it? Did you uncover things that surprised you as you were researching these sisters and this family?
Many things. I mean, there were many shocking things that I uncovered that I really didn't even feel comfortable including in the book. I mean, the behavior that Unity in particular, but also Diana, engaged in to further their connection with Hitler and to be part of that circle was shocking sometimes.
What were some of the things you uncovered?
Well, some of the things that I didn't include are some of the more scandalous, I don't even want to use the word, but the more scandalous behavior that you can find in some other sort of nonfiction depictions of that time, particularly on Unity's part. But what I found personally shocking and surprising was the way in which they single-handedly and single-mindedly went after Adolf Hitler. And the way in which, you know, for example, Unity would found out where he was at any given time, and she put herself in his path day after day after day, month after month. She knew where he had lunch when he was in Munich. She was there every single day. And that today, if that happened with a political figure, that person would be, you know, ousted, right? There would be they would be considered a stalker and that wouldn't happen. But in fact, that is how she became part of his inner circle. And that shocked me, the access, the persistence, both of them had an unshakable belief in the force of their own will. And unbelievably, they made their desires come to pass. They each became part of the very interpersonal life of Adolf Hitler, in his political ideology, in his activities, in his social life. That was shocking to me. It's like, and again, these were women who were part of the upper echelon of British society. So, you know, they were raised to believe in their own infallibility to some extent. And so that was a little bit ingrained in them. But even still, their audacity was shocking to me. And of course, it's shocking the way in which they were able to put blinders on and not acknowledge or allow themselves to personally realize the horrors that were going on around them. There was a lot of that. Those factors were really shocking to me to watch unfold and then to have to depict them from their perspective.
Oh, and what about Nancy? Because you mentioned that you read some of her novels before. The kind of story and the line does kind of lend itself to following her as the protagonist. But was there anything else that drew you towards it? Were you kind of naturally drawn towards her because she's a novelist too?
A little bit. I mean, as a writer, you are always observing the world around you. And Nancy, in particular, drew straight from her own world. You know, her most famous novels, which she wrote after World War II, so they're not during the time period in this novel. That's Love in a Cold Climate those books were a almost like idealized depiction of her early years in this eccentric kind of unsupervised household that she grew up in, where the parents really, I mean, they didn't believe in education for the girls. The girls were like a pack of feral cats worming their way around the countryside. They created their own language. They had their competitions and their conflicts. And so that snapshot was what initially drew me to the Mitfords. They're funny. They're not always kind, but they're very interesting. They're smart and witty. But when I took a look at the books that she wrote, which I did, of course, immerse myself in the books she wrote before and during this time period.
Did you read all of her?
All of them. What I found was a woman who's trying to open people's eyes through her writing. And of course, I see, you know, a certain kinship with that, because that's what I try to do with my books. You know, Wigs on the Green, which she wrote during this time period, was really an expose from a fictional standpoint of fascism. And the idiocy of it, really. And I think my guess is that she wanted to open up people's eyes to it, and maybe even her sisters. But of course, her sisters are indirectly, not indirectly and directly depicted as characters in the book, and so is Oswald Mosley. And so that just alienates them from her further. She writes a subsequent novel where she, I think, if you look at what's happening, you know, without giving away too much, the sisters become embroiled in, really, I can't describe it any other way, as treasonous activities. I mean, they're basically trying to roll out the red carpet for Hitler should he be successful in conquering Great Britain, so that there would be a puppet state in place for him when he conquered. Nancy, I think, saw the writing on the wall long before she was really willing or able to do anything about it. And so she's writing about that. So, you know, that to me was really interesting. I'm fascinated with the way in which fiction and fact are mirror images of one another, and how we can use writing as a way to open people's eyes, to muster their sensibilities and their beliefs. And I saw Nancy doing that. And of course, I did learn, which wasn't known for many decades, even after their death, that Nancy did in fact spy on her sisters and for MI5. And she did report on them, and she did play a hand in ultimately, I don't know if I should say it, but I mean, ultimately having Diana incarcerated for our activities. You know, she and Mosley were in jail for the entirety of World War II because they were a threat to Great Britain. The fact that she had to make this absolutely monumental decision, a true crisis of conscience, you know, where is my loyalty? Am I really fearful that my sister will do something that could affect the outcome of the world? And where is the line? That was fascinating to me too, because in my mind, there were different points in Nancy's journey where I felt like she should have acted maybe earlier. And it was interesting to see what would be the tipping point. When would she be in a position where she would finally say enough and cooperate with the government and give them information to keep her sister away from any sort of power and any sort of ability to influence the outcome of events?
And what about artistic license? Like, this isn't the first time you've written about historical figures, but how do you find that balance? And do you feel like sometimes you do need to have to take liberties with the facts to tell the story? How do you approach that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, as a former lawyer myself, you know, I'm deeply entrenched and sort of schooled in research, right? That's what we do, especially as a litigator. And that is, so that has stayed with me as I have moved away from the law into writing historical fiction. You know, the way I look at it, for lack of a better example, is this. All the research that I do, which is extensive, you know, it's original source material. So things, letters, journals, things written by my characters in their own hands, is kind of wedded with broader research, macro and micro things about what's going on in this particular time period. That all becomes the architecture of my story. You know, it's the foundation, the pillars, the roof. It is the structure upon which the story hangs. But of course, there's fiction. You know, I'm knitting together events. I'm filling in the gray areas that necessarily exist in the pillars, between the pillars, right? And hopefully stitching together a story that is, yes, fiction, but yes, anchored in the research. And when I'm filling in the blanks or connecting the dots, it's not willy-nilly. It's really wedded in those decade plus of logical extrapolation that is really the cornerstone of being a lawyer, right? That extrapolation is necessary to any legal argument or even building of a contract. And all of those things come into play in the story. Yes, I do make leaps, you know, sometimes I have to. Sometimes we don't know what happened, and I'm filling in the blank with what seems the most logical step for the character, for the time period. So yeah, and that's why I write fiction instead of nonfiction. I could write nonfiction about some of these women that I write about, but I feel like especially with women whose histories and stories and documentation and research weren't considered worthy of keeping or sharing until recently, we very often have more gaps than you might with a similarly situated historical man. And so in some ways, it allows us to tell a fuller story, a fuller fictional story, though, I have to say.
Okay, well, let's take another break to hear from our sponsors. So I wanted to ask you about your origin story. I usually ask authors this same question, but how did this all begin for you? And you were a corporate lawyer, weren't you? In New York, is that right?
Yeah, I was a commercial litigator in New York City at two of the world's biggest law firms.
Which firms?
Skadden Arps, Slate Meyer and Flom, and then Morrison and Forster. And that was for over 10 years before I decided to pursue this path. Yeah, so my origin story, well, I mean, how much time do you really have? But it really started for me a long, long time ago. I won't say how many decades, but I was in middle school. And I was a voracious reader as a kid. And I had this wonderful aunt who was an English professor and a poet and a rebellious nun. And she was really the one that gave me truly instrumental books for me, fiction almost always. And there was this one book she gave me called The Mists of Avalon, which doesn't, when I describe it to you, you're going to be like, huh, that book was really pivotal for you. But it was. It was groundbreaking for its time. It was a female-centric retelling of the Arthurian legend from the perspective of the women. And I had never read anything like it before. It was the same story I knew, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, told from the perspective of Guinevere and Morgan Le Fay. And suddenly a story, you could call it history, you could call it, you know, myth, that I knew was completely different when told through the perspective of the women. And it opened my eyes to all these different voices, especially women's voices, lurking in the past, hidden in the past. And initially, it started me on the path of becoming a history major. That's what I did in college. I thought maybe I'd become a professor, an archaeologist. But when I was in college, it was the first time that women in very large numbers were being encouraged to go to law school. And a lot of history majors, you probably know, end up in law school. And I had lots and lots of female friends who were ending up doing this. And it seemed a clearer path. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do with a history degree. And I also felt fortunate that I was going to be part of this big wave, right, to have these opportunities. So I ended up going to law school. I went to Boston University Law School, and I did very well. And I ended up becoming, you know, getting amazing job offers and becoming a commercial litigator in New York City.
Were you writing during this time too? Were you always working in the... Oh, you weren't. Oh.
Never. I, in fact, never even had an aspiration to write a book. I was more interested in history, right? That was really my thing. When I started practicing, however, I knew that that really wasn't what I was supposed to be doing. I liked the skills I was learning, the research, the writing, the advocacy, but I didn't love the work itself, the subject matters in particular. And so while I was still practicing, for a couple of years, I would sneak out and go to like graduate classes in history at NYU and Columbia, considering maybe going back and getting a PhD. And just out of the clear blue, I had an idea for a story. I had never intended to write. I've never taken a creative writing class. And of course, all my stories are about history and the fullness of history and rewriting back into the historical narrative the missing pieces, the missing voices.
And what was kind of the... Oh, I'm sorry, but... What,
no, I'm...
Sorry
I'm,
to interrupt. What was the kind of catalyst? Was it something... Because I've heard you speak about this, I think, before.
Yeah.
If someone said to you, at your firm. Is that
right? Yes. One of my best friends, who's still one of my best friends. We practiced together, Alana. We were having dinner in a conference room, as we did most nights, because we were there for many, many hours every day. And she asked me whether or not there would be a case I would refuse to take on moral grounds, even though my client had a really, really good legal position. And I did not have an answer to her question. That bothered me, because I thought to myself, where's my line, right? What line will I not cross? And this was a long time ago, this is in the 90s, I start in a journal that I was doing, you know, I was reading as part of, you know, CLE classes probably. I started to read about the very first few cases in which families of Holocaust victims were attempting to recover artwork that had been stolen from their families during World War II by the Nazis and ended up in museums and auction houses. And I just became fascinated. It was such an interest. It was a part of history I didn't know. It was a really fascinating kind of intersection of law and history and art history, which was something else I was really interested in. And all of a sudden, I had an idea for a book, like fully formed. And of course, the story was my very first published book, The Chrysalis, which was about, no surprise, a young female lawyer at a large New York City law firm who's asked to represent an art auction house in keeping a piece of artwork from the family who seeks to recover it. It's artwork that had been stolen from the Nazis. And we now know about that, right? We know that that happens, but there was hardly anything about that when I first came up with the idea and when the book was first published. And I wrote that book over like an 8-year period while I was practicing law. And it was kind of when I decided to make the pivot to pursue that I left being a lawyer.
And how did you get it done? It took you 8 years, but how did you find the time as a corporate lawyer to write and to get that first novel?
It was
done?
Very challenging. That's why I took 8 years. Now I know, yeah. I know all that. I didn't really know how to write a book. You know, as a commercial litigator, I worked insane hours, but sometimes you would work like around the clock for weeks and then you'd be waiting for a response so you could reply, right, to a brief or whatever. And you'd be kind of in this holding pattern that they wouldn't want you to take on another case because they knew as soon as that brief came in, you would be flat out for another month. So I would have these little pockets, a couple days here and there. I would have a shorter work day so I could work at home in the evening. So that's why it took so long. You know, maybe over a vacation, I might do some writing. I wrote it in drips and drabs during not so copious free time over a multi-year period. And when I was finally finished with it, I wouldn't say finished, as good as I could make it, given my capabilities at that time, I entered a program at NYU for people with completed manuscripts. And I worked with a professor one-on-one for 6 to 8 months. That's my best recollection.
What was the program?
I can't even remember. It was at NYU. This was a long, long time ago. And it was at that point that I thought, this is as good as I can make this book. And I was just fortunate that I connected with a literary agent who agreed that it had potential.
And after that book, did you give up your job in corporate law and just said, I'm doing this full time now?
Once I got a contract. Right. Yeah. But I've been fortunate. So ever since I got my first contract for The Chrysalis, I've published a book every 12 to 18 months for the past like 15, 17 years.
Do you ever think about going back into law?
Never, never, ever. I love what I do. It's, you know, I wouldn't say that I ever regret my time as a lawyer. I don't. You know, I learned so much about my skills, about myself, about my passions during that process. And I learned the skills that I developed as a commercial litigator, I use every single day as doing what I do. You know, the way I describe it is this, you know, I previously would research, craft briefs or arguments on behalf of a client, right? And I do the same thing now. I research, it's historical research instead of legal research. I write novels as opposed to briefs or arguments. And I advocate on behalf of my historical women. You know, I advocate to write them back into the historical narrative. So the skill sets are so similar. And I'm so grateful for all the time that I spent as a lawyer. I feel like it was kind of a necessary step in what I do now.
Going back to the book, if people want to read this or listen to it, where can they find the book?
Oh, literally anywhere, anyhow. You know, it's ebook, hard copy, audio. It's at literally every bookstore, every Audible platform, Amazon.
Because it's an Audible exclusive, isn't it? It's an Audible exclusive.
It is. You can get it other places, though. But
right.
Yeah, so it's anywhere, your indie bookstores, wherever you like to shop. Indy, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Costco, Target, wherever you like to read, you can find it.
So how did the deal with Amazon come about, the exclusive Audible audiobook?
So, I mean, this is kind of a contract business side of things. Audible rights are a separate part of your publishing contract. Some publishers choose to publish themselves. They have their own sort of audio division, audiobook division. Sourcebooks, my publisher did not have its own audiobook division. And so that's a right that we sell separately. And all of my Marie Benedict Sourcebooks books are published, audio published through Amazon, through Audible.
And so what are you working on now? What can your fans expect to see from you next?
Many, many books. I have another new book coming out in June, on June 27th, I think it is. I have a co-written series of books with Victoria Christopher Murray. We published a book about 2 years ago, The Personal Librarian, and we have our second book out on June 27th, and it's called The First Ladies. It's the story about the friendship between someone you know well, Eleanor Roosevelt, famous First Lady, and someone that most people don't know as well, Mary McLeod Bethune. She was well-known in her day, 20s, 30s, and 40s. She was a 15th child in a family, first born free. She started a college, Bethune-Cookman in College in Florida, and she became one of the most well-known advocates for equality during that time period. She and Eleanor became like BFFs in a time period of segregation when Black and white people were not supposed to be friends, and they worked behind the scenes to advance the civil rights movement in ways that, I mean, will blow your mind. I mean, these two women, they accomplished so much and really in their own way formed the foundation for the civil rights movement. It was also really important to Victoria and I, you know, who wrote a book about race, a Black and a white woman, during a period of unrest in our country. This book in some ways is autobiographical about our own friendship and the way in which, I mean, she's like a sister to me. We're extremely close. We have gotten to that place through difficult, frank conversations, the kind that we sort of imagine Eleanor and Mary have had. And so it was a really personal book on that level as well.
Well, congratulations on the Mitford affair.
Thank
it was a pleasure
so
talking to you today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm Matt Reynolds, a legal affairs writer with the ABA Journal in Chicago. Thanks for listening to today's show. If you enjoyed it, please rate us on your favorite podcasting app.